Hi, this is Bill Arnold. Missed a show or need me talking to help you sleep tonight? I have several solutions to that situation. Here are the podcasts from the show. You are the best for listening and supporting Faith Radio. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with me. I'm Bill Arnold. I am, as always, grateful to be back behind the microphone on a Monday because I love Mondays. And I hope you do, too. And I hope you had a great weekend. And again, to all you dads that probably got to do exactly what you wanted to do on Dad's Day because you got to call the shots, I hope you had a great day. And I pray that you had a great time being surrounded by family and friends and loved ones and how awesome it is to be a dad. Speaking of a great dad, my friend Jay, who's got seven kids, by the way, sent me this little piece that I would like to read because I love it when friends send me material because it means I can prep less. Anyway, it's from William Bright, who is the founder of Campus Crusade for Christ. And he said this, "Let your will be done. O God, grant us in all our doubts and uncertainties the grace to ask what you would have us do, that the spirit of wisdom may save us from all false choices, and that in your light we may see light, and in your straight path may not stumble, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen." What a great way to start Monday. We're going to take a little break, and Patrick Albanese is going to join us, and then Joanne Pittman's going to be in studio. And then Brian DeVries in hour two. It's going to be a great show. Stay tuned.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Do? Why, if I had a brain, I could
while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain.
Well, happy Monday. You know, I love on Mondays. I get a chance to catch up with my friend and colleague from prestigious West Des Moines, Patrick Albanese. I just had a listener chime in last week saying, "Hey, I just want to tell you one of my favorite segments on your show is that fella from prestigious West Des Moines. I enjoy you two veteran entertainers talking. The timing between you is interesting." And he is my guest on our Skype line right now. Patrick, how are you?
I'm well. And notice how when I sent that email in that I didn't I pretended not to know the name of the guy from prestigious West Des Moines, thereby leading credence that it came from an interested third party. Anyway, I'm well. I finally got back. I had to go get my I had to get the navigation system in my car updated, and I got lost on the way, which
that's the worst, isn't it?
Well, you know, and I think I go, is this a pre-planned thing? Is this how they convince you that you need it? You know, you show up there, I got lost. The directions on my GPS were a disaster. They go, "Yeah, that's why you need the update."
Right. They got you right where they want you.
Yeah. I mean, remember the old days when you would join, like, with the first Nautilus clubs that came out in the 70s? You know, and you're going, "I'm going to get in shape. I don't want to have sand kicked in my face on the beach." And you would go and you would join this club. They would take you through the first complimentary workout, right? And you would say, "How come there are trash cans by all the machines?" And they say, "Well, you'll find out. You'll find out." And then they take you through a workout. They introduce you to your trainer, which coincidentally happens to be probably the only guy in the 40-year history of your high school to fail shop class, you know, because he was unable to make a doorstop out of a block of wood. Who's your trainer? And this guy takes you through, and by machine number three, and you're going, I'm feeling kind of nauseous. Are you taking me on the Mr. Olympia workout?" He says, "This year's champ, you betcha." And he grabs a trash can. Now you know what the trash can's for. And by the time you're ready to leave, you know, you're waiting for the ambulance to arrive, of course. And they say, "You really need this."
Oh, right.
And you go, "You know what? You're right." And you sign up for more of it. We're so easily duped, aren't we?
Yeah.
Just easily.
And did you say, so you don't get sand kicked in your face? Because I remember it already was kicked in your face, and then you went to the Nautilus shop.
Yeah. Isn't that funny? Remember those, the Charles Atlas ads?
Oh, yeah.
And the big guy on the beach, and, you know, he kicked. Have you ever heard of anybody getting sand kicked in their face? Of the big muscle guy just walking up to some scrawny kid going, "You know what I feel like doing? Kicking sand in your face." I've never seen it happen.
I haven't either.
Yeah, but I love how but the guy worked out for like 2 weeks and came back, and did he end up kicking sand in the bully's face? I don't even remember how he
don't
got his
remember. Comforts. I know he had new respect and new muscles.
It's right. Still in pursuit. Just don't go to the beach. You won't get sand kicked in your face. Although I was at the pool and somebody brought a handful of sand just to throw at me.
How was your Father's Day yesterday?
That was wonderful. You know, the grass got cut. I had to do it. But, you know, we went to church in the morning and the kids went along agreeably. And it was a fantastic sermon. A few years ago, I was getting really discouraged with Father's Day sermons because they seem to have this attitude of, well, man, now that you're here, let's tell you all the ways you're doing things wrong. And it was a beat up session. And a few years back, they sort of switched course, and it's much more praising of men, you know, flawed,
mm-hmm.
but how important they actually are. And it's amazing because it used to be a very low attendance at the Father's Day sermon, and it was pretty packed yesterday. And I said, you know, we like to hear positive messages too. Dads like to hear positive messages because we know our job's not easy either.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was great.
Yeah. Well, I was doing some reading over the weekend, and I came across a pretty interesting article about President Dwight Eisenhower and, of course, his first inaugural address in 1953. He was quite vocal about his faith. And did you know that as much as we have focused on his military career or the time that he was president, there was one fun fact about him and his personal life. Is he was the only U.S. president to be baptized as a Christian while in office.
Wow.
Now, if that was going to be happening today, what do you think that would do to the country?
Well, you know, when Barack Obama was president, he claimed to be a Christian, and I'm not doubting that he was. But, you know, I never would hear people say, well, you know, as long as, you know, just don't put your theology on me. And I would imagine that the more secular part of society would get very nervous about a president. You know, I mean, if Trump went and did that, they'd get pretty nervous because they'd say, well, that's it. It's the end times for them.
Yeah.
Because he went and he got baptized. So I don't know. I mean, you know, my belief, like a lot of the Democrats that run and are in office and, you know, proclaim their faith, there always seems to be this wink, wink that their followers are saying, we know you're not really very devout in your faith. And we know that you're not going to push anything that's faith-based on us, or you're not going to be guided by your faith, but we know you have to fool those other guys.
Mm-hmm.
We know you have to say that because they're just not that bright. And I think maybe that's why the people got so upset with Trump getting elected, because they said, evidently that trick where we would, you know, make them think that this was important, even though we knew wink, wink, it wasn't. Now, suddenly they're saying, all right, it's time to clean house. I don't mm-hmm. know.
So I was looking over another newspaper today, one I don't read that often. It was USA Today. And there was an article on police using private doorbell cameras to help catch criminals. And it was based in your very neck of the woods, Des Moines, Iowa. And this, they were referring to Waukee police. And they're asking our residents to give the police their footage to help solve crimes. And this is becoming quite the go-to for police, because there are so many residents that are having doorbell cameras now. And when things are getting stolen and houses are getting burglarized, they're able to access that feed to help solve some crimes.
I think that's pretty cool. I don't know how many crimes you can commit on somebody's doorstep. You know, seems to be pretty limited to package theft.
Mm-hmm. But if you're breaking into somebody's house and you've got a doorbell camera that's recorded the person with a crowbar opening the door, that might be helpful.
Might be helpful. Although the next thing that's going to happen is we're going to have a whole series of doorbell camera thefts. Say, you know, okay, can we have the footage? Well, I don't have it anymore. What did they steal? They stole my doorbell camera. You know, that's going to be, those things are going to be hot property. So,
yeah.
But yeah, you know, I'm all for it. You know, you always get nervous about anything that's big brotherish, but these are homeowners voluntarily putting these cameras in. It's not the city saying, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to put a camera, you know, on the outside of your home looking out. And how long before they say, might as well have one looking in, you know, if you got nothing to hide. What it's a tool.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of it.
I had a peephole I put on my door once, but I put it in backwards, so that never worked out.
Although the thing that was really cool is whenever you looked through it, people looked like they were a mile away.
That was true. I never felt that threatened. This guy's a mile away.
He's small. He's really small. I can take that guy.
All right, Patrick, let me take a little break. Lots more with Patrick Albanese in just a minute. We'll take a short break. Welcome back to the show. I'm enjoying my conversation with Patrick Albanese, my friend and colleague from prestigious West Des Moines. We always try to catch up on Mondays to find out what exactly happened over the weekend and what we should be trying to be paying attention to as we get our week started. And I saw an article, Patrick, that Senator Richard Blumenthal, the Democrat from Connecticut, wants to introduce this new bill, Women's Health Protection Act, which basically says it's way more radical than Roe v. Wade. It says that no government entity, local, state, or federal, can have any limitations or requirements on abortion services.
Whenever a senator, when somebody introduces a piece of legislation, you say, okay, so what was not working? And obviously, this is a preemptive strike to try and stop states that are trying to have these heartbeat bills. So he's trying to do an end around that by introducing something so radical that will be on a federal level that anything a state passes, you know, I'm sure the desire is that those will be found unconstitutional, unworkable because of this thing that they got passed. Because were we lacking for abortions to be performed? You know, is there something that was happening that said, well, it's just, you know, we don't have enough of them? So this guy has to pass legislation that says we need to make it easier.
Well, he's going on the offense because he's ultimately afraid that there could be some reversal and that there are fewer abortions right now because there are fewer abortion clinics. And I think people are wising up to birth control and they're taking extra caution. And this is all good because when a child is conceived, God wants that child to be born unless there is a reason the child becomes miscarried.
Yeah. I mean, those are things that have been happening since the beginning of time. And when you read up on the stats of, you know, like things like that happening, it's a lot more common than we know. You know, sometimes women can go through a miscarriage without even knowing they were pregnant in the first place. Obviously, it does happen. But I mean, it's not comparable to terminating the life. At least, you know, let's just say our belief. Mm-hmm. How about that? I'm throwing you in there with me.
Right.
I guess I just, you know, somebody's proposing a piece of legislation that you say, well, what does this exactly cover? Are you throwing in some wording that says that this has got to be taxpayer funded, that, be, you know, some women are unable to get an abortion because they can't afford it? And so that has to be on the table, because I know that's one of their goals, is to get taxpayer funding for it. Because, and I've wrestled with this in my head, all I can figure out is that they want more abortions.
Mm-hmm.
Am I missing something here?
That's what it sounds like.
Are you guys saying there's just not enough of them? You need more? And why? Why do you need more? Why do you feel this is an issue that isn't covered? You know, we need more access and more ability. And I do worry that there's going to be a time where you can force a physician to perform an abortion that a conscience clause won't cover.
Mm-hmm. Patrick, you had an interesting exchange with a friend over the weekend, I believe, on capitalism. I don't know if you're in a place to share that, because I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, I had never really thought of it this way. But his point was, you know, people forget that there's really no such thing as capitalism. You know, Karl Marx invented the term basically so that there could be communism, socialism, but it was, capitalism was the enemy. You always have to have an enemy, you know, when you're trying to get a movement started, right? But capitalism, according to him, and I really liked the way he said it, it's freedom. It's freedom to work, freedom to pursue a better job, to work harder, get a better job, freedom to keep your money. And then do what you want with your money instead of, you know, the government taking it and buying all the things for everybody. You know, you invest it. You buy your healthcare. You decide, you know, if you want property. But what you realize with liberalism today, and especially because it's going to this democratic socialism, is that you always have to give up freedoms. You have to suppress some of those freedoms in order to have, for everybody to have things. And they have to take away your freedom. You don't get to spend your money the way you want to. I mean, do you remember back when George W. Bush was president and they were trying to set up a system whereby you could privately invest some of your Social Security funds? And it got destroyed because they said, well, people can't handle that. And it would have been wonderful if you could invest the money yourself, because that would have meant that it stays with you. Because right now, Social Security, if you die and you never collected it, or if you don't have, let's say, a spouse to give it to, it just goes away. It vanishes. You can't access that money. It's not even yours. It's just like a promise to pay. So that's what they didn't want. They wanted to take your ability to spend your money the way you saw fit, invest it how you saw fit, so that it stayed with you.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I've wrestled with this one too. Why do people wish to have this much control over other people? Because I don't. I'm having a hard enough time running my own life. You know, I can't imagine trying to make decisions for other people.
I don't want to run your life.
No.
No. I want you to run your life.
Yeah. Well, I kind of have to.
Well, I get that.
Yeah. I put out a thing on Craigslist. Nobody took me up. Yeah.
And I just wanted to publicly say I don't want to run your life. Now that I've done that, I can move on.
Yeah. You know, that's what they always say, though. The liberal politicians say, we don't want to run your life. We just want to make all your decisions for you.
Right. Now, Patrick, we've only got about 3 minutes left, which reminds me, and it probably will remind you, that as we sort of enjoyed our weekends and got to spend time with family, we now gear up again to Monday morning, and you're back on your Twitter feed and doing some research for the show, which I appreciate. But as you are scrolling through social media and you feel like it's addictive, because we've had this conversation before, it's really for a good reason, because it is addictive.
Yeah. And you want to know something? Ever since I did Banjo Camp, I'm not sure what happened to me, but I have cut way back. And I am so much happier for it. And it's funny because, you know, there's that dopamine release.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing if somebody liked, you know, I've had it happen with Facebook posts or a tweet. And, oh, my gosh, I got 37 likes. This is amazing. My sister-in-law is going through this right now. You know, she's kind of becoming a voice in some areas and people are liking her posts and I can see it consuming more and more of her time. And you go, it's dopamine.
Yeah.
It's that same drug that is at the center of every addiction.
Yeah. Well, it's keeping up with the Joneses. Say more about that.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. You know, back in the old days, I think on the street I grew up on, Mr. Bear was the only guy with a Cadillac. And, you know, so you always just assume that it was black.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a sedan DeVille. It was nice.
Nice.
Yeah. But you know, you didn't offer, like, you went to school with people and I went to Catholic grade school. So we all wore uniforms and it wasn't like somebody had a Pierre Cardin tie, you know, we all had the same clip
or Jordache jeans.
Yeah. Yeah. So you didn't even know people were from a wealthy family, but you can look at social media now. It's just a yet another way to tell everybody how much better your life is than theirs. Hey, look at my vacation. My kids are at Harvard. Look at this. Look at this. Look at this. Look at this. My raspberries are better than your raspberries. Mm. And I'm not saying that people post thinking that, but I could see where it could be in there, because it's just, I don't know if it's a human tendency to boast a little bit or if we just like to say, well, I'm doing just fine too. I'm doing great. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, you and I both have entertainer friends, and I know quite a few that they can't put a Facebook post up without saying, it's unbelievable. Yet another standing ovation. It's like, okay, you're great. I didn't know how great you were till you told me, but thank you for telling me.
But the degrees to which they're showing the world what they're doing and how well they're doing it, I think is, like you say, it's keeping up with the Joneses on steroids. And I don't know if that produces any happiness, and it's probably causes people their own pain, because when the day comes when they are not measuring up the way they once did, it's gonna cost them.
I think it will cost them, and I can be, you know, taken in by it. I have to remind myself life is good. You know, I mean, if I find myself looking at a Facebook post, like a friend of mine had up today, and I'm going, oh my gosh, he's in Milwaukee. He got to go to Milwaukee. Like, I haven't been to Milwaukee in 15 years. Oh, what a lucky guy. His life is so much better than mine. It's like, it's Milwaukee. It's nothing wrong with Milwaukee. It's a lovely town. But you go, why I'm reacting? Why? Oh, because he got a job and he got booked, and it doesn't matter where it is, but it was just a subtle thing that, you know, I go, I can't consume this stuff. Mm-hmm. Not just not stuff, but if I consume it, I'm constantly, you know, comparing other people's lives to mine.
Yeah.
And, you know, you always come up short.
Yeah. And I think the key is for believers is to pursue what Paul talks about in terms of contentment, where I want to be content in all circumstances. I am content in all circumstances, because otherwise you're off the track pretty fast.
Well, and you know, it's, if you are fortunate enough in life to, on a scale of 1 to 10, have most of your experiences fall in the 8 range, mm-hmm. which is pretty high up there. You know, I mean, to expect life to always be a constant 10, well, you'll just have to reset what a 10 is.
Right.
Because that will get dull. You can, we see it all the time with people that have absolutely everything. And then some of them end up taking their own lives because there was nowhere left to go.
Yeah.
You say, well, you can't be content with anything less than a 10. That's not healthy, because that's not doable.
I know. And as we enter the season of Wimbledon, which is coming up in England, I am always reminded of Boris Becker, one of the great Wimbledon champions of all time, who won his first title at 17. I think he won his second title at 19. And they asked him what he considers to be his biggest challenge at this stage. And he said, to not take my own life.
He would now see, what's amazing is he was smart enough to know that that young age that I've achieved the pinnacle, and there's nothing higher.
Yeah.
And
not enough.
Nothing, which means everything other than this won't satisfy.
Right.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Yeah, be content in all things. Now,
yeah. Yeah. Patrick, always good to chat. I will talk to you again probably tomorrow personally, and I'll look forward to our next conversation on next Monday.
Sounds great.
All right, have a great day. Patrick Albanese has been my guest and my colleague and friend from prestigious West Des Moines. We'll take a little break, and then Joanne Pittman's going to be on the show. We're very much looking forward to chatting with her and finding out what exactly is going on in China. Be right back. Welcome back to the show. You could listen to that all afternoon. Joanne Pittman is my guest in the studio. She's an author. She's the editor of China Source, and she spent 28 years working in China as an English teacher, a language student, program director, and a cross-cultural trainer for organizations and businesses engaged in China. That, my friends, is commitment. She also taught Chinese at the University of Northwestern here, and Chinese culture and communications at Wheaton College and Taylor University. She's authored Survival Chinese Lessons and The Bells Are Not Silent, Story of Church Bells in China, which is a fascinating book. And Joanne, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
You know, we hear, I just have to tell the listeners off, we hadn't gone on yet, and I asked her about how are things in China, and she said, complicated. I said, well, let's close in prayer, huh?
That's pretty much it.
That's pretty much when it comes to China, isn't it?
Yes, you have to start there.
Yeah, and why is that?
Well, it's a country of 1.4 billion people. And 1.4 billion people.
Yes.
So that is obviously going to lead to a lot of complication. It has a long history. It's a country that's rising in the world and trying to find its place in the world, and challenging some other structures. But I think just the sheer size of China makes it complicated. That we often say in a country of 1.4 billion people, anything you hear about China is true somewhere.
Of course.
It's not necessarily the whole story.
Yeah. How much do you think we in America know about China? I mean, we read headlines and I see, you know, the tariffs that U.S. has put upon China. And I don't know. What do we make of that? What's the impact of that?
The impact of the tariffs?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not an economist. So I think the impact of the tariffs are going to be, you know, our can openers here in the U.S. are going to get more expensive because it's just a tax. It's an import tax. Mm-hmm. And so when Target buys things from China, they have to pay the tax. So it's not that China's paying the tax. It's mostly that we are. So I think an immediate impact for Americans is that the prices of imported goods from China, which are a lot, will probably go up. And but then the other result is that the reason that they're put on is because the belief that the pressure of having the higher taxes on goods that China exports will cause buyers to maybe go other places and potentially harm China as well. And so it's sort of a tactic to try to get them to, you know, come around to negotiate on various trade issues.
28 years working and living there. Would you remind us all what China is like politically and spiritually?
Sure. Politically, China is a one-party state. The Chinese Communist Party is in power, and it's been in power since 1949. And they hold all political power in China. They do not tolerate any opposition parties. So it's a one-party state. It's an authoritarian state where, like I said, the party cannot be challenged. And it's a very authoritarian political system. What the party says, you know, that's what happens. Spiritually, I would say it's very complicated as well.
Yeah, once again, that
yeah,
word
it's complicated.
Complicated.
It's very complicated. The Chinese Communist Party officially espouses atheism. And so anybody that joins the Communist Party has to, you know, kind of swear atheism. Atheism is actually taught in the schools. It's not that, you know, they just say, you know, you can't believe in religion. They actually actively teach atheism.
Mm-hmm.
That said, traditional Chinese culture has a lot of spiritual components to it. Traditional Chinese ancestor worship and belief in the spirit realm is still very strong in the countryside. Buddhism would probably be the largest religion in terms of the numbers of people who would claim to be Buddhist. And there are also Taoists, which is an indigenous Chinese religion. And there are Muslims in China, about 10 million Muslims, and then Protestant Christians and Catholic Christians. So China has five religions that they give legal status to. Christianity is probably for the last 20 years has been the fastest growing. And so you have, nobody knows the number of Christians in China. The government says about 30 million. High estimates are 100 million. So it's probably in between there, maybe 50 to 70 million Christians.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about teaching atheism, what would be the support materials for that?
They would use a lot of Darwin.
Darwin?
Yeah. Evolution and, you know, man comes from monkeys and things like that. There is no God. It's all materialist philosophy.
Mm-hmm. And when you, as a person who's worked in China and led many to Christ, when they start to hear the gospel, they must just get so excited.
At first, I think it's puzzling because, you know, because atheism is taught in the schools, and that's kind of like what everybody starts out with, unless they come from a family where there's religious practice. The gospel presentation is a little bit different because you can't really come in and say, you know, Jesus loves you and died on the cross for your sins, or God loves you and died, you know, God loves you and sent his son, because they don't believe in God. So a lot of times in sharing the gospel, you have to go back and start with addressing the question of is there a God or not? Because if you don't believe that there's a God, hearing God loves you is like you telling me Santa Claus loves me. It doesn't have any meaning. And so you have to start back at, is there a God? And you look at evidence of that, and you begin to wrestle with that. And then you move from there into, okay, who is God? What is he like? What is the purpose?
Yeah.
Things like that.
But when God places eternity in our hearts, doesn't that instantly make us restless in search of him?
I think for a lot of people it does. But, you know, if you're in an environment where you're just told one thing, that God does not exist, breaking through that barrier is not easy for a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Now, when we, not to get back to the political stand that China takes, but There has been a, has there been not some trends towards democracy in China lately?
Have there been trends to? I would say no.
No, okay. For some reason, I thought maybe there was.
Well, I think if you go back over the last 70 years, China in October they're going to be celebrating the 70th anniversary of the establishment of the People's Republic of China, okay. Which is the communists coming to power. The first 30 years were really bad, a lot of persecution, the party establishing its control. During the 60s and 70s, again, there was the government trying to get religion out. It was under Mao, so he was really a dictator. He ruled like an emperor. Mm-hmm. The last 20 years have seen a lot more openness and a lot more space for civil society, with religion growing and people having more freedoms, the freedom of, I'm not going to go so far as to say freedom of speech, but people having a lot more space to function in their lives without political interference.
Mm-hmm.
Is that more democracy? I don't think so.
Yeah,
because
probably not.
Democracy is like, do they have a say in the government?
Right.
And, no, they don't.
Yeah. So, Joanne, I would love for you to paint some pictures for our listeners about what it is looks like in terms of the urban life and the rural life in China. I mean, there's got to be such an incredible difference between those two.
Yes. Urban China and rural China are very, very different. And right now the population is split about 50-50. When I went to China in 1984, 80% of the population lived in the countryside and 20% lived in the cities. Now that's 50-50. So there's been a massive migration of people into the cities, or reclassification of rural areas into urban districts. Chinese cities, if you look at Beijing or Shanghai, mm-hmm. these are modern, innovative cities. If you were to visit Shanghai, you would look around and see the gleaming skyscrapers, the technology, and I can see why people would go and say the West has no chance. I mean, these are amazing, world-class, wealthy, innovative cities. And then you can, with Starbucks on every corner, and you can get in your Maserati car and drive 2 hours out of Shanghai and be in a village where people are living fairly lifestyles that wouldn't be that different from maybe 50 or 60 years ago, except they have a cell phone and a television and they might mm-hmm. have a car as well. So there's a huge disparity, and there's a lot of wealth in the cities and a lot of poverty in the countryside.
Mm-hmm. When you were living over there, where were you living and how were you living and what color was your Maserati?
Well, I had a black bicycle.
Okay.
Later on as things got better in China, I had a pink bicycle.
But, oh, nice.
Yeah. I lived in three different cities in China, and one in central China called Zhengzhou, and that was back in the 80s when there were no cars and we just rode black bicycles and mm-hmm. everybody wore their little Mao suits. Then I lived in the northern city of Chongqing in the 90s when things were beginning to change and become more prosperous. And I had a beautiful white bicycle then.
Nice.
Never did drive a car in China. And then for 15 years, I lived in Beijing. And I was there during the 2008 Olympics.
Mm-hmm. Exciting. That must have been quite exciting.
Yeah. It was really exciting to see the city sort of transform itself over a period of about 10 or 12 years.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the social trends going on in China right now?
Some of the social trends, one is that the party is beginning to sort of reestablish its control over society. So they're putting more restrictions on things like media that had been loosened for a while. But I think one of the big things, two really interesting things, is one is the proliferation of social media.
Mm-hmm.
China has a very robust social media platform called WeChat, which everybody is on. And it's really taken over because WeChat is more than just, here's pictures of my friends and here's what I'm doing. It's really become an ecosystem. So everybody, they use it for paying things,
really?
For purchasing. They link it to their bank account. And so when I was in Beijing last November and I went just to a supermarket or to a market, and I would pull out my cash and they would look at me like, what's wrong with you? Why don't you use your phone to pay? And I'm like, mm-hmm. well, I said, I'm from the United States. We're a little behind the times on this. So the way in which the smartphone and social media has completely taken over and become ubiquitous in life. And then the other thing I would say is that the government is developing this social credit system where they're They have different behaviors, and what they say they want to do is build a culture of trust. You know, so if you do a bad thing in society, we'll take points off, and then when you go to buy an airplane ticket, you know, you're not going to be able to buy it. And it's because we have a credit system here, but it's based on our consumption patterns. Mm-hmm. China doesn't have that, so they're trying to build this thing called social credit to try to get to create a culture of trust.
Wow.
But unfortunately, it can also be used by the government. It's like, well, if we don't like you, then we can use this to, you know, to make life difficult for you.
What kind of behavior would create demerits in your file?
Misbehaving on the subway, like when I was in Beijing in November.
I do that all the time.
When I was in Beijing,
I wouldn't be able to buy a thing over
there. There were all these signs on the subway, you know, you're not allowed to eat, and all these rules that you're not supposed to do on the subway. And so if you do those, then you're going to get demoted. And there's cameras everywhere. There isn't an inch in a major city. There isn't an inch of space outside your home when you're not on some sort of a surveillance camera.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so not paying your bills, not paying your taxes, things like that.
So they're developing this, or it's already in practice?
Both. It's okay. In practice somewhat. They're in the process of developing it. And it's being rolled out and used in various places, in different ways in various places.
When you talk about Big Brother keeping an eye on you, whoa.
Yeah, it's pretty spooky.
Yeah, because you really don't go anywhere where you're not on reviewable footage, right?
Never. Not from the time you're outside your door of your apartment, because there's going to be surveillance cameras in the hallway of an apartment building, you know, for security cameras, mm-hmm. like you've got here. And then when you're on the street, there's multiple cameras. I was standing in a subway in Shanghai in November, and I just stood in one spot, and I looked around, and I counted 26 cameras.
Wow.
So I think that's a major, you know, social trend.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy. Joanne Pittman's my guest, and she is the Senior Vice President of China Source, has 28 years working in China as an English teacher and a language student, program director. She's got quite a resume. We'll take a little break and be right back with Joanne in 90 seconds. Welcome back to the show. I have Joanne Pittman in studio. She's Senior Vice President of China Source. She's been to China, well, she's worked there 28 years, and she has got a love for adventure. She just returned from Newfoundland.
They call it up there.
Yeah. 5,760 miles she traveled with her dear, darling 92-year-old mother. And some other siblings, right?
My sister and brother-in-law.
Sister and brother. Yeah, awesome. So, 3-week trip. You've got adventure in your blood.
I do.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's go back to China, because I think we all fill in the blanks if we don't have good information. And you, having spent so much time there, in 2019, are churches and pastors still facing the kind of persecution that we think they are?
It's complicated.
That's your go-to.
That's my go-to answer.
Your go-to
right.
answer, which I love.
I would say over the last 20 years, there's been a lessening of persecution and harassment by the government. The government gave civil society more space, and that included religion. So you saw the proliferation of urban house churches and public churches, and that were not registered. And there was sort of a reluctant tolerance from the government towards Protestant Christianity and the proliferation of house churches and things. But under the current leadership, that tolerance is being dialed back.
Mm-hmm.
And they're increasingly viewing people who worship in unregistered Christian churches as a potential threat, or the existence of these churches. And so the last year really has seen an uptick in pressure and harassment, and sometimes persecution of particularly high-profile house church leaders.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of a mixed bag. You know, some of the high-profile Christian leaders in China have been detained and are, you know, jailed, and their churches shut down. But at the same time, there are still probably thousands of smaller house churches that have not been affected.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a... But it's definitely tightening over the last year.
Does the Chinese government allow for any churches?
Yes.
Okay.
If you go into every major city in China, you're going to find fairly large churches.
And are there cameras in there?
Oh, yes.
Well, they monitor everything?
There's, if you're outside of your apartment, there's no, there's cameras in every restaurant. You know, part of it is for security. So there are registered churches that are sanctioned by the government, and you can find those in every city in China. Some of them are quite large. I attended one in Beijing that had 5,000 people every Sunday morning, and so Christianity is a legal religion. It's legally sanctioned, and there are churches. And then there are unregistered churches that there's more of those, and those are the ones that the government views with a little bit more suspicion,
mm-hmm.
because they're outside of their control.
Yeah, have the challenges that churches been facing been the same for decades and decades?
Well, I think, you know, I think so, because in China, we tend to want to kind of put on, when we look at the church in China, we want to focus on the political lens. And I think there's a false assumption in the West that the biggest challenge for the church in China is the political system, it's the government,
mm-hmm.
and the pressures and the rules and the attempt for control and all of that. And that certainly is a problem. I want to say that that's not. But for Christians in China, I think in addition to government pressure, there are other more, shall we say, normal issues and challenges facing the church. Like, how do you do church governance? How do you raise your children to be Christians in a very secular environment? How do you conduct business as a Christian in a very corrupt business environment? How do you get theological training?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot more normal challenges than we hear about. We in the West tend to assume that, oh, if the government would stop bothering them, then everything would be fine. But the government, government harassment, government pressure is just part of the environment of China, whether you're a Christian or not. And so that's
must
just
be exhausted.
It can be very exhausting.
Chinese government must be exhausted for the work they got to do.
Right. And the people can be exhausted, because you're always like, okay, you know, is this going to get me into trouble?
Yeah.
And I often say that in China, the boundaries, so it's like the government says, you can practice your religion, but we get to set the boundaries. You can believe what you want. We get to set the boundaries, but those boundaries move. They're rubber and invisible.
Okay.
So you're always trying to figure out what can I do, what can I not do, and so I think for the church, it's more, in addition to the government pressure, the challenges from the government, it's a lot of more normal stuff that would be very familiar to us in our churches here.
Mm.
How do you train your children? How do you have a Christian, a godly family, godly relationship? How do you find a Christian spouse?
Sure.
And most Christians day to day are dealing with that as much as the government.
Mm-hmm. So 28 years of living there, did you ever get yourself in trouble? Because you seem like kind of a troublemaker.
No, not really.
Why did I know that was going to be the answer?
Because I wanted to stay there. And,
exactly.
And so, you know, we tried to know where the boundaries were and stay inside of them.
Yeah. Well, Joanne, what are some of the things that absolutely amaze you about Christianity in China?
I think it's the growth. I think in 1949, when the communists came to power, there were estimated number of Protestant Christians was about 700,000. And that was after 150 years of missionary work. Okay.
700,000.
Right. And then that was 1949. In 1949 to 79, China closed down. They tried to drive religion out of Chinese. That was the era of really, really intense bad persecution. But by 1979, when China began to open up and survey, their surveys were taken, the estimate was 10 million.
Whoa.
700,000 to 10 million during the time of intense persecution.
Wow.
And then from 79 to now, let's pick 70 million.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Let's pick 71.
That's kind of Book of Acts
type. This to be more exciting.
Sure. So 700,000 to 70 million in a space of, I'm not good at math.
Yeah.
In a short time.
A bunch of years.
In a bunch of years. under government harassment and for at least 30 years of that intense persecution.
That's so cool. What about the kids? What issues are the kids facing over there?
Chinese youth?
Yeah.
Christian youth? Or
yeah.
Anybody?
Yeah.
The same as here. Peer pressure, materialism, spending too much time on their phones. Young people in China also spend a lot of time studying. They have a very rigorous educational system. Mm-hmm. So by the time you hit 10th grade, all you do is study. So even Christian parents, they struggle with, you know, I can't bring my kid to church because he's got to study.
Really?
All the time. I mean, it's that intense. So the pressure of the educational system is really, really intense on young people in China.
Wow. And what does the school year consist of? Is it year round or is it?
No.
Do they get a little summer break?
They get a shorter summer break, but they get a longer winter break. It goes from around September 1st to around the middle of January, and then they get a month off for Chinese New Year, and then they go until usually the end of June. Mm-hmm. So it's 2 months summer break and 1 month in the winter.
Mm-hmm. What would be some prayer requests, prayer needs for our brothers and sisters in China?
Well, I think right now, you know, they're adjusting to a new political environment after about 20 years of things getting more open and they're having a little bit more space to function. That space is beginning to shrink. And there's a lot of Christians who didn't experience a tighter or a more persecution environment, so that they would be wise in how to handle that, and that they would be able to withstand the increasing pressures that are coming on them. I would say also for the church, Christians, as they deal with the everyday issues that Christians everywhere face that mm-hmm. I mentioned, you know, how do we live as salt and light in our communities?
Mm-hmm. And Joanne, you wrote a great book called The Bells Are Not Silent, Stories of Church Bells in China. We've only got 90 seconds. Can you share a little story from that book?
Yes. I stumbled across a church bell in southern China in 2012, and it had an inscription on it. And it said that the bell was from a church in Kansas from 1863. And I decided I wanted to discover the story of that bell, and in the process discovered numerous church bells in China and that they have a story to tell about God's faithfulness to the church in China.
How does a bell get from Kansas to China?
Well, I think it went in 1913, so it would have gone by train across the United States and then by ship, and then it would have been carried up the river.
Yeah, I mean,
Baptist missionaries in Sichuan.
Oh.
It was donated by a church in Kansas, and they had a missionary in Sichuan, in Sichuan province, and they wanted to send this bell to her, support her missionary work, I guess.
Oh, that's fantastic. And then they...
But it's a story of God's faithfulness, and the bells are just the vehicle to tell that story.
Yeah, and chinasource.org is a good place to go learn about all things China.
Yes, you can come and learn about the church in China. We go deeper and broader and wider than
and I bet you
most
would
headlines.
You would encourage someone to go be a missionary, wouldn't you?
I would encourage somebody to go serve in China,
yeah.
Yes.
And Joanne is saying that with a gigantic smile on her face because that was her work for 28 years. And Joanne, thanks for coming in the studio. It's so nice to see you. Your stories are fascinating and your life is amazing.
Thank
and
you.
You've said
I'm blessed.
Yes. You've said yes to God, though. And look what he's done.
Do it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Joanne Pittman's been my guest. We'll take a little break. And then we're full steam into hour two. Brian DeVries is going to be joining me. Can't wait. Look forward to it. Be back in a few minutes. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.